You may wonder why I've chosen this phrase, "The Lord had given me many sons," from 1 Chronicles. I think it's true to say that as a sovereign, David had a lot of problems with the fact that he had all these sons. Many years ago, I was asked to talk to a small group of teenagers about David. And they were very perceptive. I asked them, I said, what kind of a dad do you think he was? Ooh. Well, he spoiled them, some said, and then others said, well, you know, he was very busy. It's very difficult for him to keep an eye on all these children. And it was quite moving, the way the young people, you know, were able to assess David's difficulties. But with a family like that, you know, he would only have a little bit of time for each of his sons. And so in some ways they were growing up without perhaps, you know, the real benefits of a father that they could talk to and discuss problems with. And that might explain the fact that the next session, which we're going to look at, where David is a sovereign, most of his problems were derived really from difficulties with his sons. Now, David's capacity as a sovereign was compromised by his sin. Early monarchs often wielded absolute power. They regarded themselves above the law. But not David. This wasn't an option that he could have, was it? He must live by the law of the God he served and loved. If he was a man after God's own heart, he must reign righteously and justly, as God is righteous and just. And until this problem with Uriah and Bathsheba, that's exactly what he'd done. But now he must reign with a handicap. It's not clear how much the palace knew what had happened. I strongly suspect that they were pretty familiar with what was going on, at least in part. And everyone would know that up to this point, David had been a wonderful example, but now he'd failed. And this had ramifications, you know, especially with his sons. I mean, we've said, haven't we, 4 or 5 deaths are indirectly attributable to David's sin, or his inability to assert his kingly authority without appearing to be a hypocrite. Well, we're going to move into 2 Samuel 13, where we're going to consider Amnon and Tamar. Good looks seem to have run in David's family. Absalom was handsome, his sister Tamar was very beautiful, and sadly, Amnon fell in love with her, his half-sister. Now, Amnon had a friend, Jonadab, David's nephew, who, according to the NIV, was a very shrewd man. Now, the AV subtle man isn't the same word as applied to the serpent in Genesis. You could probably say he was quite knowledgeable, and he was a thinker. He was a shrewd man. Now, he noticed Amnon's condition and discovered that he was lovesick for Tamar. Now, we perhaps have to bear in mind that the modern free association that we have between our young people, boys and girls, would not obtain in those days. I suspect the girls were raised quite separately from the boys, and Amnon might only have a fleeting glance from now and again off his sister, half-sister rather, and only perhaps occasionally have a chance to talk to her. Now, the morality of his feelings are, of course, contrary to the law of God, which makes it quite plain that these relationships have to be kept proper. You're not to be involved with your sister, whether born at home or abroad. That's not on. Now, as I say, it might be very difficult in those days for them to develop what we might call today healthy relationships, where, you know, boys and girls, especially in junior school, and I went to a co-ed grammar, and it was said to us by the head and the headmistress that we were an experiment, and we had to behave ourselves. Well, it's interesting. I mean, co-education now is far more common, but in those days it was probably hardly known at all. And Amnon might have reflected that Abraham married his half-sister, Sarah. You know, if it was good enough for Abraham, well, was it good enough for him? It didn't override the law, but it might have encouraged him. And the fact that Amnon was David's eldest son probably made him think that he would be the heir apparent and the day would come when he would succeed to the throne and he could do what he liked, as ancient kings often did. Now, Jonadab, shrewd or wise as he was, had no scruples. He said, "You're a king's son. Why shouldn't you get what you want?" Amnon couldn't visit Tamar, and she couldn't normally visit him. So they had to have a ruse. And the idea was, if he was to pretend to be sick and ask for Tamar to come and cook something special for him, it might be allowed. Well, the fact that David visited him seems to indicate that, you know, he made out his condition was serious and David was presumably taken in. A sick man posed no danger, and anyway, she was his sister. To David, it would all seem very innocent, I'm sure. So David ordered Tamar to do what Amnon had asked. Well, watching the cooking didn't restore his appetite, and so he commanded the servants to leave, suggesting that if Tamar was to come and feed him herself, he might manage to eat something. Well, alone with Tamar, of course, Amnon raped her. She, of course, protested when she realized what his intentions were. She suggested that if he spoke to the king might approve this. It's unlikely, but at least perhaps she hoped that by suggesting that, he would leave her alone and it might deter him. And it would give the impression that she'd be willing to marry him if permission was granted. Well, none of this deterred him. And the strange thing is that afterwards he hated her with the same passion which he'd lusted after her. It was evident that he didn't really love her, he merely wanted her, and there's a big difference, isn't there? You know, one minute she's on a pedestal, and then after this she's sullied at his feet. He dismissed her, but she wouldn't go. His raping her was bad enough, but to dismiss her now as a ruined girl was even worse. Had he insisted that they married, at least it would ensure that she'd be provided for. Who would want her now? And so, you know, she's in a very difficult situation. So she goes back home with her garments rent and ashes on her head as an indication of a sorrow, as it were, and her condition. And Absalom realised what had happened. He consoled her with a comment that since Amnon was a relative, it had been kept in the family, as though that somehow made it right. And she remained in Absalom's house, so at least she was being cared for. When David heard what had happened, he was furious. But he could do little else but be furious. You see, Amnon should actually have been executed for what he'd done. Leviticus 20 and Deuteronomy 27 make that quite plain. But how could David exact such a penalty against his own firstborn son when he himself had committed adultery and murder? So, David is in a difficulty. Now, of course, Absalom intended to solve the problem his own way. So he kept his peace almost unnaturally, saying neither good or evil to Amnon. He just, you know, went along as though nothing had happened, it seems. And this lasted for some 2 years, by which time everyone, I'm sure, who knew about it would have assumed that he would take no revenge as to what had happened to his sister. Well, it came to the time of year when there was sheep shearing, and when that was all over, of course, they had celebrations. There was an open invitation to all the princes and to the king himself to come to the sort of festivities that followed the sheep shearing. David suggested to Absalom that that would be, you know, too much of a burden for him. If everyone took up the invitation, it would be very severe for Absalom to provide, you know, for all the people who might turn up. But Absalom persisted and secured the king's agreement that Amnon and the other princes should go. David blessed Absalom, perhaps thinking that the special mention of having Amnon there indicated that all was forgiven regarding Tamar. All this was, of course, merely a subterfuge to provide Absalom with the opportunity to kill Amnon. And at the height of the celebrations, while Amnon was relaxed and off guard, his heart merry with wine, Absalom's servants obeyed the command to kill him. we keep having these classical pictures. This is the confusion, presumably, that occurred at the assassination of Amnon. Well, of course, pandemonium broke out. Each of the princes saddled his mule and fled. Possibly they went off in all directions. A messenger had seen what had happened and left even more quickly, travelling ahead to bring the news to David. He assumed that Amnon was only the first to die and told David that all the other princes had perished too. Now, just imagine that news to David. He knew there were going to be problems, but the thought that he'd lost all his princes. The news was absolutely devastating. God had warned David through Nathan that the sword would not depart from his house. But he couldn't imagine that this would destroy the whole house, the entire house, at one fell swoop. And there was a problem. Had not God promised to build him a house? It did seem as though God had forsaken him, and all his sons now were dead. Well, at this point, Jonadab, Amnon's close friend, arrived with more accurate news. Not only did he inform them that only Amnon had perished, but disclosed that this was only to be expected. You know, he might be astute and so on, but that's the sort of person who often upsets you, you know, when they tell you, well, you should have known that, as though they knew what was going to happen. I think probably he was perhaps trying it on. It seems Absalom had been plotting since the Tamar incident. So why didn't Jonadab warn his friend, Amnon? It's hard to understand if he said, well, it's going to happen, it's obvious. There's a lovely phrase, isn't there? With friends like that, who needs enemies? He really didn't do his friend much good. Well, eventually the royal princes returned home, but Absalom, of course, had to flee, and he fled to his in-laws. There's now considerable sadness all round, but David continued to mourn for Absalom. It was as though Absalom had gone and had died. And so the record says the soul of King David longed to go forth to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. This is so characteristic, isn't it, of David? He grieved for Bathsheba's child while it struggled for life. So here there was nothing further to be done regarding Amnon. He deserved punishment, but not to be murdered in cold blood and without a proper trial. Absalom, by his behaviour, was effectively admitting that what he'd done was a serious crime, and so, you know, he sort of banished himself. So the king had failed to execute sovereignty once more. Tamar had been despoiled, Amnon had been murdered, Absalom was exiled. Well, of course, David wanted him to come home, and so we find that the next part of 2 Samuel deals with Absalom's exile and return. Now, Joab apparently was deeply concerned about Absalom's absence. A weak king would result in a weak kingdom, and this was not in Joab's interest. If David became ineffective while Absalom was in exile, David would have to rely on one of the other sons to deputise for him. And later events to show that Absalom was obviously, or clearly to most people, the obvious successor to David. The view of the people was quite clear on this. Well, Joab decided if the king wouldn't listen to reason from his closest associates, then we could perhaps trap him into making the right decision, was presumably what Joab decided. So he sought cooperation from a wise woman from Tekoa, about 6 miles south of Bethlehem, to play the part of an appellant at the king's court, seeking the king's judgment in a difficult case. Well, she appeared in deep mourning, and she related the facts of the case. And she told David that her two sons had quarrelled, and in the ensuing fight, one had killed the other. The family, and particularly the avenger of blood, were demanding that the surviving son should be put to death in accordance with the law. And she said, well, if that happens, I've lost both my sons. And the family line, the family name would die out. Well, David recognised that this was a difficult case. The law was clear, but the consequences, you know, were really quite terrible. I mean, he said, presumably to himself, well, the incident wasn't premeditated. They were brothers and they suddenly had a quarrel. And it might even be that the death was accidental. So he presumably asked, well, was a weapon involved? No. He wasn't ambushed? No. Well, then it was not murder, but manslaughter. Now, David assured this widow that no one would be allowed to kill her surviving son. And once more, David learned, thou art the man. The woman said, let thine handmaid, I pray, speak a word to my lord the king. He said, say on. And the woman said, wherefore hast thou devised such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one which is guilty, in that the king doth not fetch home again his banished one. And then she goes on to say, for we must needs die, and are as water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither doth God take away life, but deviseth means that he that is banished be not outcast from him. God devises means or ways. It's lovely that, isn't it? He'd done that in sparing David. Once more, David had to recognise his own failure to demonstrate his sovereignty. But he recognised that his hand had been forced this time by Job. And so he asked the question, is the hand of Job with thee in all this? And the woman answered and said, as thy soul liveth, my lord the king, none can turn to the right hand to the left from aught that my lord the king hath spoken. For thy servant Job, he bade me, and put all these words in the mouth of thine handmaid. This seems to me to indicate that Job had tried to persuade the king repeatedly, but without success. We can't help wondering whether David was becoming rather difficult to talk to. He could now hardly refuse Job's plea, and so he agreed that Absalom could return, but David would not receive him. That is, he must not appear at court. He could come back to his home, but he was not to appear at court. Well, 2 years passed, exactly the time that he'd waited to take his revenge on Amnon. But now the time passed slowly. Absalom sent for Job. He probably considered that if Job could achieve the return, at least in part, by this ruse using this wise woman, then maybe he could achieve a change in heart now to allow him to be part of the court again. Job ignored the summons. Perhaps the king was being difficult and Job had to tread carefully, like walking on eggs as it were. So Absalom sent for him once more to talk to him and nothing happened, he wouldn't come. So he thought, I know how to get him to come and talk to me. So he set fire to his barley crop. He couldn't ignore that. And Job turned up immediately. And so Job then agreed to plead with David. Well, once more, David was impotent to take the opportunity to rebuke Absalom. He ought to have only accepted Absalom after a stern lecture, and preferably in the presence of everyone in the court, so everyone saw that Absalom had been given a good dressing down and that David was in charge and wouldn't put up with this sort of behaviour in future. But it didn't happen. Well, how could he? As an adulterer and a murderer, he could hardly start accusing Absalom of failure. Well, we now get to the stage which is a crisis, isn't it? Absalom's revolt. Once back in favour, Absalom began to acquire the trappings of the heir apparent. He looked the part. This is, again, someone's idea of what he looked like. The hair is interesting. We'll come back to that in a minute or so. He was handsome and he was determined to become king. And so the record says, now, in all Israel, there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he polled his hair, now it was every year's end that he polled it, because the hair was heavy on him, therefore he polled it. How much did it weigh? It weighed 200 shekels. Now, if I got the maths right, that's about 5 pounds, or 2.3 kilograms. Now that is like 2.5 bags of sugar on your head. No wonder once he'd pulled it, it was a load off his mind, literally. But it says that he had three sons and one daughter, whose name was Tamar. Now, there's a problem with that, because maybe someone can help. When he built the pillar, and it's recorded in 2 Samuel 18 later, it was because he had no children. So whether he lost them, I don't know. If anyone has some ideas on that, I'd love to hear them after this talk. Well, if he's going to be king, he has to look like a king and behave like a king. So Absalom rose up early. He'd had a retinue of 50 men, of course, as a personal bodyguard. And he made himself popular in this way. He got up early and stood by the way to the gate. And when a man who had a suit was to come to the king for judgment, Absalom intercepted him and called him and said, what city are you? And he would reply, I'm one of the tribes of Israel. And Absalom would say, when he'd listened to what the man's case was that he wanted to present to the king, he'd say, oh, your matters are good and right, but there's no man deputed to the king to hear thee. So it's possible at this time that David was ill again, and he hadn't deputed anyone to step into his shoes and hear the various cases that would normally come before the king. And then you'd say, oh, that I were made a judge in a land, that every man which had any suit or cause might come to me, and I would do him justice. And of course, if he said to each party, you know, as he intercepted perhaps the man who was bringing an accusation, and also the man who was trying to defend the case, and he says to the first one, oh, you've got a jolly good case, I'm right with you on this one. If I were king and I was judging, I'd find in your favour. And then meet the other, the opposition, and say exactly the same thing. Everyone would go away thinking, if only Absalom was king, things would be so different. And not only that, you know, although he is a prince, look what he does. When any man came nigh to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand and took hold of him, presumably, no, get up, no need to bow to me. And then he would give the kissing on the cheeks, as it were, to say, you know, we're friends. And so everyone who came to the king for judgment was being won over in this clever way for Absalom. And that lovely phrase, Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel, and presumably he stole them from David. So, by making sure that everyone thought that Absalom was the sort of judge they could trust, because he was always, you know, whoever it was, he was in favour of their case, he could steal their hearts, couldn't he? They would go home thinking, well, I wasn't able to present my case before the king, but if Absalom was king, how different it might be. And Absalom's comment that there's nobody deputed suggests that David might well have been incapacitated again at this time. Psalm 41 might give us a clue about that. He says the Lord will support him upon his couch of languishing. The Lord made his bed in his sickness. Heal my soul, because I've sinned against thee. Perhaps that's how David felt. My enemies speak evil against me, saying, when shall he die and his name perish? And it may be that they thought at that time that David was in effect on his deathbed. And no wonder Absalom then was getting excited at the prospect of stepping in his shoes. And then, if he come to see me, he speaketh vanity. His heart gathereth iniquity to itself. When he goeth abroad, he telleth it. All that hate me whisper together against me. Against me do they devise my hurt. And that might well be a reference to the situation where Absalom is stealing the people. And it may well be an evil disease, you see. Perhaps he's they think it's fatal. An evil disease cleaveth faster. Now that he lieth, he shall rise no more. No chance, perhaps, that anyone would be deputed. He was too sick to have a deputy, perhaps, at this stage. And then an evil disease cleaveth fast to him. Now he lieth, he'll rise no more. Yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. Now, using the word friend, I wonder if this is really Ahithophel and not Absalom. But of course, we know later that Ahithophel is one of those who sided with Absalom. So the psalm fits the condition reasonably well. And now, having laid the foundations for his attempt to seize power, Absalom now begins to build the edifice of his revolt. He sought to go into exile to fulfill a vow which he'd made when he was banished, as it were, from court. And David would respect this. I mean, he may have made similar vows when he was in times of extremity. And so 200 invitees to these celebrations provided a smokescreen of respectability. And Ahithophel, David's counsellor, was sent for, and the conspiracy was strong, says the record. The news of Absalom's bid for the throne was then conveyed to David. Arise, let us free. Let us free, says David. Why did this warrior king give in so easily? It wasn't personal fear, was it? David wasn't a fearful man. If he was recovering from a serious illness, an illness that they thought might prove fatal, then he'd be weak physically, wouldn't he? But I think there was a more important consideration. You see, he believed what Nathan had said. Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity upon you. One who is close by you, says the NIV. Well, you couldn't have anything closer than your firstborn son, could you? And Psalm 16 gives us a clue as to David's frame of mind at this time. Preserve me, O God, for in thee do I put my trust. I have said unto the Lord, Thou art my Lord. I have no good beyond thee. As for the saints, or the people in the earth, they are excellent, in whom is all my delight. And then he goes on to say, Their souls shall be multiplied that exchange the Lord for another God. Now, actually, it doesn't seem to be about, you know, idolatry. The AV gives just hasten after another. And David says, the drink offerings of blood I'll not offer. As though he's saying, I'm not going to make Jerusalem a bloodbath. I'm not going to fight Absalom in this case. There'll just be carnage and the people will suffer. And he won't even mention who it is. I won't take their names upon my lips. Now, apparently, some of these words here are not in the... Are not in the Hebrew text. Now, the AV, if you've got it open, reads, Their sorrow shall be multiplied that hasten after another, and God is in italics. They're hastening after another king. In other words, they don't want David, they want Absalom. But David says, well, I'm not going to pour out blood in Jerusalem and have all this carnage, so I leave. And so David here is referring to another leader, that's Absalom, and he's not going to make Jerusalem a bloodbath. And how ironic. What's Absalom's name mean? Absalom, father of peace. And where is the capital? Jerusalem, the possession of peace. You know, how ironic that at this time it seems to be just endless problems for David. So David has to leave, and we must now consider his exile. It must have been hard for David, but as he'd said, he's not going to resist, because all that will happen is the people will suffer. And it's been said by one or two fine Bible students, there are some wonderful parallels between what happened to David going into exile and what happened to the Lord Jesus on the night in which he was betrayed by his familiar friend. If you can get a copy of Selwyn's book, The Oracles of the New Testament, he compares the Greek of the Gospel and the Greek of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, and the parallels are remarkable. And he makes the point that, quoting Stanley, another writer on this, he quotes, There's no single day in the Jewish history so elaborate an account remains as that which describes the memorable flight. There is none that combines so many of David's characteristics. And you just compare the parallels between what happened to David and what happened to the Lord Jesus. And just the places, you know, he went to Gethsemane and you'll find in the account of David, these places are mentioned, and the parallels, as I say, are really quite remarkable. It's almost as though this incident was prophetic of what would happen to the Lord Jesus. Well, when Ittai the Gittite appeared in order to join the fleeing party, David was moved to suggest that as a stranger he shouldn't risk joining them, but go home instead, along with his brethren. And his response is absolutely beautiful. As the Lord liveth, and as my Lord the King liveth, surely in what place my Lord the King shall be, whether for death or for life, even there also will thy servant be. Very reminiscent of Ruth's assertion, isn't it? You know, he's saying, whatever happens, David, I want to be with you. He was a truly loyal servant of David. I'm sure David was very glad to have his support. And it's interesting, sometime later, he was actually made sort of general in charge of a third of David's army. So, as the Lord did, David passed over the brook Kidron, and Zadok and Abiathar, along with the Levites, appeared and suggested they ought to take the ark with them. If they had the ark with them, God would be with them. Now, that's a lovely touching indication, isn't it, the support that these men had, that they believed that if David, you know, got his ark or the Lord's ark, everything would be well. And of course, it wouldn't be with Absalom and the conspirators, would it? But David said, no, this is not appropriate. Carry back the ark of God. If I find favour in the eyes of the Lord, he'll bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. You know, that's lovely, isn't it? David says, we don't really need this sort of talisman. If God's going to bring me back, he'll bring me back. And if he doesn't, you know, God's will be done. And David took the line that if Zadok and Abiathar went back with the ark, they could act as his eyes and ears in the city. And they'd be able to convey what was going on through their respective sons, Ahimaaz and Jonathan. Well, the news that Ahithophel had defected was another blow for David, because, of course, he's one of his counsellors, a man he relied on. And David prayed that God would turn the counsel of Ahithophel to foolishness. It's interesting, isn't it, that the prayer was answered. God did do was not make it foolish, but rather that it would be rejected. It was probably good counsel, but God arranged for it to be rejected when it was given later. And the proposal of Hushai actually intended, were given, and they helped David to escape and eventually regain his throne. Well, David gets to the top of the ascent of Mount of Olives. Hushai, the archite, appears, his garment rent, earth on his head as a sign of sorrow, and he said, I want to join you, David. But there was a far more important role that David wanted him to fulfill. He wants him to feign allegiance to Absalom and attempt to defeat the council of Ahithophel, and also contribute to what you might call the intelligence gathering via the sons of Zadok and Abiathar. Well, as David went over the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, turns up with a couple of asses laden with bread and raisins and fruit and wine to nourish the party. Very generous of him, of course. But David wants to know, well, wait a minute, you know, what's happened to Mephibosheth, the old master? Well, and whether it's true or not, Ziba makes it out that, he was hoping to stay behind and he would take over his grandfather's throne. He was hoping to be king. And at that news, David says, right, Mephibosheth's estate is given to you, Ziba. And no doubt that was probably quite pleasing for him. As David arrives at Bahurim, Shimei, the son of Gera, appears and starts cursing David and pelting him with stones and earth. He seems to have regarded David's being responsible for Saul's demise and took some comfort in the apparent poetic justice of Absalom's insurrection. Abishai had a ready remedy. I'll shut him up for you, David. He won't curse you once he's lost his head. What a brutal solution. But that's how it was. No, you won't, says David. If my own flesh and blood are seeking my life, this man has the right to curse as much as he likes. And in any case, he said, the Lord has bidden him to curse me. Now, that's very difficult to understand. I don't think it's true, but I'm sure David began to feel, well, you know, this was another consequence of his former sin. He deserved it. And so he's not going to take it out on this man who's cursing. Well, we come now to the problem of the council. What should Absalom do now? Now, David's left. How are we going to solve the problem? Well, Hushai the Archite had returned to Absalom, as David had commanded. Absalom was quite suspicious. You know, why did you not go with David? And he replies, well, he would serve whom the Lord and the people has chosen as king. This was no lie. It's just couched in a word that made Absalom presumably think he meant him. And he met the question with another question, which again is quite a ruse sometimes. Why shouldn't I serve you? And of course, Absalom couldn't give him a reason why he shouldn't serve him. So the matter was solved. So Absalom now has two counsellors. Ideal, the two best brains in the country, if you like. What should he do? What would Ahithophel think should be done next? Well, he had two suggestions. First, as a quite clear indication, you've taken over your father's throne, take his concubines. It's a political expedient to show contempt for your father. He should do this openly with a tent erected on the palace roof, you know, the place from which David actually spied Bathsheba. Second, he should allow Ahithophel to take 12,000 men and pursue David without delay. He would ambush the group while they were still exhausted, kill David, and let his immediate supporters escape. And then all Israel and ultimately David's men would accept Absalom as king. Oh, that seemed excellent advice. And, you know, here's a man whose reputation's impeccable. Absalom was quite keen on this, but he needed to know, did Hushai actually agree? Well, Hushai said that, well, normally Ahithophel's advice was first rate. I mean, that's a good opening, isn't it? Normally he's spot on. But on this occasion, sadly, his advice is flawed. It's a stroke of genius, isn't it? Because it played on the idea that nobody, not even Ahithophel, was infallible. And of course, Hushai is saying, and I'm really concerned, David, that you get the very best advice. So he was asked for his advice. But first of all, he sets out the flaws in Ahithophel's counsel. He said, well, David, Joab, Abishai, and the rest of David's men are experienced, fearless warriors. They were embittered, and they were in exile, and so, having nothing to lose, they would be ruthless and merciless in their opposition to Absalom. Thirdly, David and his immediate staff would not be with the majority. They'd go into hiding, as in Saul's day, and they'd be difficult to find. So if he was able to defeat David's followers, he still wouldn't necessarily be able to kill David. And then, of course, there's a possibility, the fourth one was, if Absalom's men were ambushed by David's troops and quite a few of them were killed, that would cause panic, and then the whole thing would fall apart. And those who remained would have, you know, memories of the days of the past when David was infallible. You couldn't beat him. And so the whole thing would collapse. So he says, Absalom, what you need is a different strategy to defeat David. Call all Israel together and raise a massive army that can't be defeated. Lead the troops yourself. Now, this would pander to Absalom, wouldn't it? Oh, yes, I can ride in the front of this vast army. And when David is finally located, you know, such a large force will definitely annihilate him. And if he seeks refuge in a city, we'll pull it down brick by brick, stone by stone. This is the way to defeat David. Well, Absalom and the court decided that this advice was far superior to Ahithophel's counsel. Unbeknown to them, of course, it was the Lord's hand in the matter. Well, one of the sad things is that Ahithophel committed suicide. And again, the parallel is wonderful with Judas, isn't it? His familiar friend who betrayed him. He returned home, set his house in order, and hanged himself. You know, I wonder if that extreme response is because he'd never been rejected before. But there again, it might have been his wisdom that guided him to do this. Could he have realised that Hushai's advice would mean Absalom's defeat? And if Absalom was defeated, David would return. And then how could his familiar friend, with whom he took sweet counsel, face David? Would he not be disgraced and possibly executed for treason? It was better to take his own life. Well, the end of this session, of course, is the death of Absalom. The battle is clearly in prospect. David divides his men into three groups. Joab, Abishai and Ittai lead each of these. He wanted to take charge himself, but the people wouldn't hear of it. He was the target of the rebels, so he shouldn't risk his life. They will go into the battle and he must remain behind. And the last order to his troops was very poignant, wasn't it? Deal gently with Absalom for my sake. Absalom was guilty of murder, disloyalty, and now treason. And for David, he was still a favourite son. Well, the battle was engaged in woodland, and of course, most people think that the only reason Absalom failed, because although he's no warrior, you remember he got caught up in a tree. Now, I don't think it was his long hair. The record seems to make it quite plain that actually he was caught with his head, perhaps in a fork of a bough, and maybe the force with which he hit it did damage, perhaps knocked him out, or for all we know, broke his neck. Certainly it would have stunned him, and this thick bough. Well, one of David's men found him and reported it to Joab, and he says, "You should have dispatched him straight away." And of course the man said, "Oh no, if I did, you'd have left me high and dry." So Joab sort of takes the line, "Well, I haven't got time to talk to you," and he goes off and thrusts three darts through the heart of Absalom. The trumpet sounds, and Joab, tries to re-rally the troops. And of course, Absalom's body was thrown ignominiously into a pit in the forest and covered with a great heap of stones. There would be no state funeral for this traitor. Nathan's prophecy had gained another victim. And one of the sad things, isn't it, that when the news came back, there were two people who wanted to run, it was a bit sad that when they were seen bringing news, and of course the fact that you've got one or two runners in the past meant that this was victory. If you've been defeated in battle, there'll be a number of stragglers trying to get home. But when you've got one man running as fast as he can to bring the news, it almost certainly means victory. And that's how it was interpreted, of course. It cheered David at first, but when the news finally came, it was sad news. The Cushite was asked, "Is all well with the young man Absalom?" Not "How has the battle gone?" He was more concerned about his son. The Cushite answered, "The enemies of my lord the king and all that rise up against thee to do thee hurt be as that young man is." So that was a roundabout way of saying that Absalom is dead, and this was the news that David had dreaded. He couldn't contain himself, and so he went up into the room above the gate. David was heartbroken. Nathan's prophecy had been fulfilled once more, and all the returning victors crept back silently into the city, like men who had been defeated. There was no victory parade, and Joab was furious. It was the last straw. So he says to David, "It's wonderful, isn't it? Fathers and mothers have lost their sons, and in fact, wives are now widows, children fatherless. And you'd been quite happy if everyone had perished and Absalom had survived." So David has to do something about it. And of course he agrees to receive the army. There is now, in a sense, almost a power vacuum. And one of the things I just want to comment upon is the childishness of the situation that when David returned. Of course, there were going to be no executions. There would be an amnesty. David was not going to take revenge on anybody. But the thing that I really find very strange is the childishness of the people when David comes back. The attitude was that the majority of Israel had vexed that Judah was the first to welcome the king back. And they behave as though they've got shares in the king. You know, Israel says, in effect, we've got 10 shares. Judah's only got one share. What, you know, it should have been our turn to bring the king back. You know, Judah, you've only got a single share in David. We've got more than that. And I wonder if this was, in fact, you know, a portent of what might happen later in the case of Solomon, when ultimately, after Solomon's death, the kingdom was divided. Well, there was more death to follow, wasn't there? That Sheba, son of Bichri, tried to get yet another rebellion and rallied Israel behind him because they were upset that Judah had been the first to show initiative bringing David back. And of course, Amasa comes across, and he was told to rally the whole of Israel to David in 3 days. And of course, ultimately, it looked as though when that time was fulfilled, but he hadn't done it, that Sheba had gone into revolt. And of course, eventually, Sheba had to be quelled and so on. You know, it's a very sad state of affairs, isn't it, when you think you come back to a situation where David returned to the kingdom and the squabbling goes on. In our next address, we have to think about David as a statesman. And I hope that that will perhaps restore something of our admiration for David when we review his life. But we can summarise where we've got to at this stage. Although David's sins were forgiven, we've got the death of Bathsheba's child, we've got Amnon's lust for Tamar, we've got Absalom's murder of Amnon, and Absalom's rebellion and death. It was nothing but problems for David, just because in one moment perhaps he relaxed his godliness and took Bathsheba. But I think, and I hope, that when we consider now, that in our next talk, the summary, as it were, of David's life, we'll be able to see that in many ways, what often was a problem became eventually a blessing.